famous running of the spectral index, the fact that it might not be constant for all k values. And even WMAP says it's just a hint because the errors are so large, it's still consistent with zero running. But I think it's interesting to just consider what happens if you take this hint seriously. What if that is really what's going on? Because if you do, then it's difficult to reconcile such fast running with a simple model of inflation where you only have a single inflaton.
All of that coming from the low k?
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Well, by low k, do you mean like the quadrupole problem? No, because the quadrupole is just... It's a high k. A high k is important. If you take the Lyman alpha out, then you get less significant evidence. Also, the low k, the quadrupole, that's just one data point or two possibly, and you're fitting to 1,000 multipoles. So.
I don't know if you want to talk about phenomenology as opposed to inflation models, but I've heard it said by some people that in fact this claim is not self-consistent with the rest of the WMAP data, because if you take this and extrapolate down to galaxy scales that would have been formed at redshifts of Z, I think around 15 or something like that, you find that if something that would form a galaxy is an A sigma fluctuation, and so it doesn't exist at all. There's no probability for making such early galaxy. But the one of the main features of the WMAP data is they found evidence for early reionization.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think that comes from a very early generation of stars that were made in very early galaxies, then that's inconsistent with this amount of running with respect on the network.
Is that just assuming that the m by d log k then is the same as this on all scales?
Well,
I mean, you're extrapolating
that's what they do. They treat it as.
The way this is treated in the WMAP papers is as if you have a linear interpolation formula.
No, I understand that. I'm asking, is that scale on which you're producing that? You're asking the galaxies are 8-second fluctuations. Is that within the range based on your extrapolation is made, or extrapolating it further to other case scales? I think it's further down.
You think it's even further? Okay, perhaps.
And there's a whole discussion recently about stars perhaps forming before galaxies. Does that change?
Well, that might change. Stars form before galaxies.
Yeah. Since the WMAP paper, there have been a few other papers which say that there's actually no evidence. There have been a couple other papers that got values, central values, which were closer to zero. Interestingly, though, just this morning, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey came out with a very big paper where they combined their data with WMAP to do a global determination of cosmological parameters. And I spent 45 minutes this morning trying to print out a color transparency to show you that, but I didn't manage. But, so what I wanted to show you was all of the parameters, but here's what they get for the running of the spectral index. In their abstract, they emphasize, and in the paper, that plain vanilla inflation with no running and flat or a spectral index of 1 is consistent with the data. But it's interesting just to look at this probability distribution function and to note that it's still the central value is rather far from 1. A value of minus 0.1 is... it's far from zero. Even though 0.1 maybe doesn't sound like much, you have to understand that in the slow roll formalism, this running arises at second order. And so it's difficult to reconcile it with slow roll inflation. And just to show you, well, I think, Mark, you were one of the people who were involved in that with Chung. It is possible to find single field potentials which give you this much running and also enough inflation, but you really have to work hard. They look quite contrived. And to show you that it's difficult, suppose you make some reasonable restriction on the shape of the potential, for instance, that it's renormalizable. Well, maybe it doesn't have to be renormalizable, but this is just to illustrate that if you restrict the potential to have some degree of simplicity, and then you try to match these central values, there's the data themselves give you a lot of freedom. I mean, yeah.
Before you move on to the top of the screen, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
So, how much of a range of log n have you seen now? It's like 10?
Yeah, so what I'm showing in this picture is the relevant range of log k for, yeah, that's what's needed for getting the Doppler peaks. So here I've got a potential that has 5 free parameters. I'm fixing 2 things plus the overall amplitude. So I'm fixing 3 of them, and then there's 2 still left to vary. And so by varying those, I can create a family of power spectra. This is the primordial power spectrum. It's a function of k, which all match in around the pivot point of 0.05 inverse megaparsecs, where these things are fixed. And you see that you can have pretty wide variations when you go away from that pivot point, but all of these, with the exception of this green one, are reasonably good fits to the data. Here are the chi-squareds. Sorry? An even dimension? That's right. You need to have, so the V3, well, it depends where you take the zero of the potential to be. In fact, for my purposes, I took when it crosses when the horizon crossing is at the pivot point, that's when phi is equal to zero. So it's true. You need V1 and V3 to be non-zero, and V3 is what's giving you this tilt. It turns out it's the third derivative of the potential that gives you the, not the tilt, but the running of the spectral index.
But in principle, you have a much larger range of k, not
So
there is running at this level, it will be there's many things.
Yeah. I think eventually, yes. My point is that at the moment we still have the freedom to.
Would these parameters really give you 60 e folds as you push it out further? I mean, you got 10 here, but you got.
No, that's coming.
Okay.
Yeah. So all I'm requiring to get this is the 10 e foldings of inflation that we see in the microwave sky. So then you ask, well, what do the potentials look like that give rise to those power spectra? And they look like this. So the circled part is the part that you're actually sensitive to through the measurements, and the rest is all just extrapolation based on this restriction I placed on the potential. And in this close-up, you can sort of see you need a little bump, and that's this cubic term in the potential that's giving rise to the running of the index. So,
where is the data?
Oh, this is not data. This is a picture of the potential that gave rise to.
I know, but I don't understand.
I didn't show you the data.
Focus on the central values and the theorists here. Since the errors.
Right. I didn't show you the data, but I showed you these chi-squareds that I got by plugging this into the WMAP's likelihood code. So those are fits to the data. So the point here is that this is a potential that doesn't support very much inflation. You're starting off somewhere up here rolling fast. You come into this region, get your 10 E foldings of inflation, and then if you look closely, maybe it's not so easy to see, but actually most of these potentials are still above zero when you hit the bottom. And so if you want this to give you enough inflation, you have to imagine that there's another field coming out of the screen here, which is taking over the job. It's, you have another inflaton, and you need to get the other 50 E foldings of inflation from the rolling of that other field. Yes, but as I said, if you insist on getting this large running, then the thing that you end up drawing looks extremely contrived. And this Mark Trodden and Dan Chung and they did this exercise, and when you see how ugly these potentials look, then I think you will agree that this is a nicer possibility. Yeah, but still, you also don't get enough E foldings of inflation.
But just stay at the same time.
It just
goes
flat?
Well.
I mean, you could piece together potential, it's true. I mean, that's all.
Draw
it by hand. You could make one with a bump and then piece on something and it just goes flat.
Yeah. Okay. It's not a proof, it's just suggestive. And so what I'm saying it's suggestive of is double inflation, where you have two fields doing the job. So well, it's a little bit different. It has a different name. So this is...
I'm sure that if Andre was here, he would give us 15 minutes explanation.
This is inspired by a variant of it, hybrid inflation, called inverted hybrid inflation, but my variant is called perverted, because what it's doing is it's using the second field that normally ends inflation to give you the bulk of inflation. But that 50 E foldings is inflation that you don't see directly. It's happening after the CMB modes have exited. So it's easy to embed this. The field I called phi before, I'm going to call it chi here. And so you can couple it to another field phi with an elongated, a distorted Mexican hat potential, such that the picture is I happen to be starting up here, and this line is the potential I was showing you before. So it comes down, does its funny business, hits the bottom, and then the phi field takes over and gives you the bulk of the remaining inflation. So that's a somewhat simple model. And when you analyze it to see what do you have to do to make it fit the data, you find out that it's not that difficult, and well, I don't want to go through everything, but the point is that when you satisfy all the constraints, the most stringent one is constraints on some coupling constants in BEV that's appearing in the in that potential. In Planck units, this combination by the Kobe normalization has to be 10 to the minus 6. But if you take all of these to be order 0.1 or so, and B can be even 0.1 of the Planck mass, you see that that's not a very stringent constraint. And this is just demonstrating the virtue of hybrid inflation, basically the fact that by adding these complications, you give yourself more freedom to dial parameters, and so you ameliorate the fine-tuning problems of single-field inflation.
What happened to the scalar-to-tensor ratio in these models? I mean, normally in hybrid inflation, you decouple it, right? But here you're going to get another 50 folds of inflation from your second field. Does that change?
Well, isn't it just the case that it's still going to depend on the overall scale of inflation?
Well, no, that'll give me the value, but I'm asking about the ratio. So there's this consistency condition in one field, right? Mm-hmm. And tensor Lyman scale is 12.3 epsilon. So, which gets violated in the two field usually because you're allowed to turn off the potential very, very quickly by the second field. Well,
yeah, and also, in fact, that's another thing that you mentioned. So I was assuming that I happened to start up here, and so I'll roll down this way and then go that way. But of course, I could do something a little bit different. And so I don't know the answer, but in addition to what you're saying, you'd also expect isocurvature fluctuations. And so that would be another smoking gun of this sort of picture, in addition to running spectral index. Okay, so that's just an advertisement for thinking about inflation with more than one field. And now I would like to come to string theory from seemingly a totally different direction, but the two things may somehow fit together.
Is there something that particularly points to potential that you'd like to get from, say, two fields? What if you're, say, three?
Well, I'm going to come to that, too. Two is just the next simplest possibility.
Right. Do you get rid of fine-tuning even more?
Well, I think it's very likely. I think you get rid of fine-tuning even more.
Right, so.
And I'm going to mention that after this.
How do you count?
No, not
always.
You could add more parameters.
Well, yeah, you may have to. That's right. You may have to fine-tune more of them.
But the question, I'm sorry, the part of the question is what you want to dominate at any one time. I mean, even in multiple field models, it's usually one field that's doing most of the work at any one time.
Okay.
And so here, if you have two field models, there's kind of one place where they intersect, if you like, where the dynamics becomes, you get freedom from two fields. But in general, a place where multiple fields, if you like, would intersect need not be at one point. All three fields, for example, need not be doing form at any one point.
Right.
So you might just get a set of two-field effects.
One hallmark, wouldn't it be that there would be some kind of break, some particular time where things change?
I think you could see features in the spectrum if you're lucky enough that happens at the right time.
In hyperinflation, usually that break is the end of inflation. That's the second field turns on and signals the end of the slow roll condition for the first field. That's all I was saying. Third field becomes in later,
here
might not affect
just at the end of the
field. Right. So you might hope that that's going to happen soon enough that you can see something at small scales. No, the quadrupole is affected by the beginning of inflation.
Okay.
Is it sort of contrived to expect that you're going to have one phase controlled by one field and another phase controlled by another field? I mean, if you have some generic function, wouldn't you expect that it's a complicated interplay of
Yeah, I would say so, but since the period of the inflation that we directly see is only this amount of 10, then you might still think that your chances of having it switch from one field to another during that 10 might not be so great.
I mean, if you're rolling on a complicated two or three-dimensional potential landscape, you don't really think of it as being so clean and separate. You might just be doing some spiral motion.
So in general, I mean, one should consider much more general inflationary paths. And because of these isocurvature fluctuations, which can only be about 10% of the total density perturbation, that will place some constraints on these models.
I have a question related to that. If I have, a space of any number of dimensions you like, and I'm just thinking about one trajectory through that space, and it doesn't
the path doesn't stall out at any point. The velocity vector is not exactly equal to zero. Then you can always go to path length coordinates. And the whole Lagrangian looks like a single field, which is, you know, has a canonically normalized kinetic term and some potential, which is gotten by tracing
the time dependent combinatorial.
No.
It's effectively a single, you can represent it with Einstein's equation of a single degree of freedom. Right. That's what Tony is saying.
Just there are even fluctuations, of course, there it's very different. There will be fluctuations in all these different directions that are sufficiently flat. But if I'm just thinking about the background, then it's just some trajectory. And as long as phi vector dot is not equal to zero, I think I can always go to the path length as a new variable and rewrite the action as a single field.
Is there any initial direction, or don't you have to choose?
You choose a particular trajectory. Well, we're talking about some particular trajectory. Mm-hmm. So it's a posteriori. Okay.
That's the reconstruction.
So I guess what you're somehow arguing is that by looking at it as a multiple field thing, something that in the single field language would look fine-tuned actually turns out not to be fine-tuned.
I think that's a fair
that's
statement.
That's somehow the way this works out. But thinking of it in multi. Okay. So
the key difference, as Tom was mentioning, is the fluctuations, because if there is, so that's where you're going to look for the differences between a single, an effective single field and
But I think Jim would also say that the multiple field description will look much less fine-tuned. I'm understanding correctly.
Yeah, I think so.
How can it be? You see something that's, or you know already that's reasonably simple, simply explained by a single degree of freedom.
Okay, I mean, the problem is it's trivial. Write down whatever you want if you're given the freedom of non-analytic, non-polynomial potential. So he was being constrained by the fact that he wanted a quartic potential. Now if you put in four extra field, in the sense you're going up to eighth order in the potential. You go to 10 fields, you're going up to 40th order. Yeah. Gives you anything you want to draw up naturally.
Oh,
the
strength.
Naturalness is really an autisticity in the field, and you're in effect, by going to more fields, going to more turns and tails.
Yes, I think connecting with autonomous, actually, if you take a generic quartic potential and you look at an arbitrary trajectory in that, that will be very hard to describe. That will take a huge number of parameters to describe as a function of one field, whereas it only takes a small number of things to describe the quartic potential. I mean, you can probably have some chaotic motion on a sufficiently complicated quartic potential.
But the key feature for you is somehow the saddle point that you have when you make the transition. We expect to be able to model that by just having a couple more powers in the potential.
You should look at this paper that Chung et al. Wrote to see how bad these potentials look when you reconstruct them.
It's true that you're constrained. It's true that if you allow yourself to write down any function, I don't think one could argue with this description in terms of one degree of freedom, it seems perfectly reasonable, but it might be ugly. What does that mean? But I mean, part of what Laurie is saying is that, I mean, it's true that if you write down some generics in quantum potential, then the motion could be extremely complicated. I mean, in general, it can be extremely complicated. But the picture in these models is that, you know, you have some special directions of those things which are much flatter than the other capable thing to give you potential. In that case, you're being kind of forced into the values relatively quickly from some wide original set of initial conditions. And so even though you could in principle have a lot of different behavior, you don't necessarily expect to have that.
Jim, is your sole motivation this running of speculative index or exploring this kind of
That was my motivation to start thinking more seriously about multi-field inflation. But I think once you open that door, you realize that this could be helpful for solving some of the problems of getting inflation from string theory. And it may really be thrust upon you by string theory by this landscape picture. And then your perspective is, okay, so if that's the case, how will I test for it? And my argument is that, well, maybe these features in the spectral index will be characteristic of that kind of inflation. Okay, so now I'd like to change gears and discuss one of these problems that we've had with trying to get inflation to work in string theory. And this is the KKLMMT paper, in which you're living in a compactification that looks like ADS5 in some region of moduli space. And at large radii, this is glued onto a Calabi-Yau. The ADS curvature, it's coming from a source which is a stack of N3 brains. And actually, I don't know if where they go in this picture exactly.
Flux.
Yeah, it's a flux, so I shouldn't consider it to be. Okay. So when you insert an anti-D3 brain in the picture, it falls down this gravitational well and likes to stay down here. And it exerts a weak attraction on a probe 3 brain. And the weakness is due to the warping. So you can get exponentially small warp factors determined by ratios of fluxes in this flux compactification, and that is explaining the flatness of the inflaton potential. And the problem that was pointed out by these authors is that once in this picture, you haven't yet stabilized the volume of the Calabi-Yau space, and as soon as you insert a mechanism to stabilize it, you end up ruining the flatness of this inflaton potential. Here, R1, the position of the 3 brain, is playing the role of the inflaton. Now, the reason this comes about is a kind of technical one, as far as I understand, that to describe this in supergravity language, the natural field, which is a super field, and which fits into this Kähler metric understanding of things, is a field rho that's related to the actual Calabi-Yau volume by a shift that depends on this function of the position of the 3 brain. So you can imagine when this 3 brain is over in the Calabi-Yau, it has complexified coordinates. These are three-dimensional vectors. And you can just imagine this is phi star phi. So it's like the mass of the inflaton field, because phi is essentially the inflaton field. And so when you introduce a mechanism that stabilizes this volume, but it's referring to the superfield rho, you fix rho, you give rho some steep potential, and that fixes this linear combination of the volume and the inflaton field in such a way that now you get new dependence on the inflaton field through the stabilization mechanism, which gives it too big a mass. And so you've ruined the slow roll of the inflaton potential. Well, Cliff Burgess, when he was here earlier, was discussing this problem with people, and he was suggesting that perhaps we can get inflation through a D term instead of F term. So this F term, which was introduced through the stabilization, that's what's screwing things up for us. What if you introduce some new field which allows the F term to become smaller and replace it with a D term, which is actually driving inflation? How would this work? Well, you assume that there's anomalous U engage symmetry with gauge multiplet V. You introduce some matter that carries the U1 charge, and a field that contains an axion that cancels this anomaly through the Green-Schwarz mechanism. And then these fields enter into the Kähler function through some function of B and some function of Q, and also into the gauge kinetic function. And this gives rise to a D term in addition to the F term that we had before. So Cliff's idea was that perhaps we can arrange for things to work so that this field B likes to minimize the F term during inflation, so it's essentially negligible, but then this D term is big and it's driving inflation. But phi is still the inflaton, this brain modulus is still the inflaton, because it's controlling when B likes to shift its BEV, so then the D term becomes minimized and the F term becomes important again. And the way I imagine how this could work is, so schematically, the total potential for the inflaton and this new field has the following form, where the DD bar potential is, that's the one that was already there before we introduced stabilization or D terms. And now here's this problematic contribution coming from the stabilization, but now it's allowed to depend on another field, and here's the new D term. So if it happened that the mass squared of the B field was positive, so when you're in the vacuum state that makes the D term big and the F term small, if the mass squared is positive for some range of phi, but then changes sign as phi is rolling down its potential, then that would trigger a change in the BEV of B, and that would signal the end of inflation. So it's a similar to hybrid models. I'm not writing down the complicated expression for this F term, but just to make a toy model, suppose that expression behaved similarly to a Mexican hat potential, and also for the D term. And you can see how this would work. If you look at the mass squared of the B field, you see that it gets a positive contribution from the F term and a negative contribution from the D term if I make an assumption about the two BEVs that are appearing here. And this is what we want. When phi gets small enough, this will go negative, and then you'll want to shift over to the other vacuum where B is minimizing the D term, but now the F term is giving a positive definite mass squared. Okay, so, and I think it's possible to choose these functions to give that kind of behavior.
This is consistent with, I mean, the imaginary part of B, if I'm remembering correctly, what B is a periodic variable. So you really.
Yeah, B, the imaginary part of B is the axion.
The axion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, some direct quantization of that periodicity, which for some. So is that consistent with the kinds of, I mean, presumably not with the things you've actually written down,
right.
But do you think there's a problem with implementing the idea of
that? Well, that's a good question. So I'd have to do this with cosines or something of B if it does work.
Yeah. B in the superpotential, B typically can only appear as in exponentials because of this kind of constraint.
Mm. Okay. Well, so this is exactly the kind of feedback that I wanted to get from this audience, because I'm not a supergravity person. I'm not a string theory person, and so I'd like to know sounds plausible or promising, or if it sounds like a dead end. That's one thing that may be a problem. So there's this general question of, do you think that this can come easily from, or naturally from, string theory? And then how this might relate to what I was saying before. Here I'm still getting all my inflation from the original inflaton field, but I have introduced a number of other fields, and so there's the possibility now we could think about getting some part of the inflation from the other fields and not doing it all with one field. So does any other string person have reactions to this?
It's hard. I mean, we could try to add more brains, right? So you had your picture with the D3 brains at the bottom. And there's limits to what you can add without changing the model drastically. For example, D5 brains break supersymmetry very badly in combination with D3 brains, and it's hard to see how you keep the features. Which is too bad, because D3s and D5s together do give you D terms. D7s can be added naturally effectively, but they preserve the same supersymmetries as the D3s. So I don't think you'd get things that you realize by D3 brains. I know that Renata and also Quevedo and Burgess are some combination of people have made some models like this, but it's not, I don't think they've got a complete model like KKL MMT does. One of the things too is you're kind of restricted to geometries because the region of large warping that KKLT uses is a codimension 6. It's just a D3 brain. And if you use some higher dimensional thing, you'd be kind of. Does anybody know? Can you make warp regions with things of higher dimension than D3 brains? Is that
with what?
Higher dimension than D3 brains. It's a little harder.
Like with a 5 brain.
You use 5 brains, say. But the one thing they're dilatonic, so you start to, they don't have these nice conformal throats that KKLT use to generate hierarchy of scales.
I don't know whether you can do that in a way that fits into a four-dimensional.
But that would be one. I mean, that would be the most natural way to try to generalize KKLT. That's right. That's the one.
I know when Renata talked here about the work, Renata Kalisch, when she talked here about the work that she was doing, and I have to say, I didn't really understand what the point was, so what I'm going to say is very, very fuzzy, but she seemed to be worrying about the kind of D-terms, you know, in string theory, what the D-terms you get from these anomalous U1s are not really classic Iaeli-Alpolis D terms, okay? They're really, you know, they're field dependent. It's not, you know, like adding a constant. There's even an old argument due to Ed Witten that ordinary Iaeli-Alpolis D terms are not allowed in string theory because if you just stick in a C parameter into the supergravity Lagrangian, then when you get U1 field transformations of things that depend on the other background fields, and when the background fields have some random devs, it looks like fields have fractional charges. And then in a fundamental theory like string theory, where all charges are quantized because of brains and direct quantization, that you shouldn't be able to get that. Okay, so this is an argument that's in a footnote in an old paper of Witten's from back in the 80s. And we've never seen in string theory a regular Iaeli-Alpolis D term, just these things that you get from the anomalous U1. So when Renata talked, I got the impression that she was saying that for them to get their mechanism to work, they had to assume a regular Iaeli-Alpolis D term. Yeah, why that I didn't follow clearly enough. I don't know, maybe somebody else remembers.
Well, I don't know, but I think in this language, a regular term is just data equals a constant, data equals x, data a linear function, because then you're just getting the mm-hmm. Whereas what you tend to get from string theory, the same argument saying is logs,
right.
which is very different. And one of the differences is how these potentials scale at large volume. You know, the models and how they wanted to make the potential to scale at large volume like nothing that you can get from string theory. In the Fourier-Schottenstein frame, all the potentials go to zero at large volume that you get from wrap rates, fluxes, even cosmological constants. It's not clear whether it wasn't entirely clear what her motivation was. Part of it was to tune away this phi squared term. But I don't understand why all of it didn't make sense. So just the one over five of the fourth. So you started, by the way, early on you played with a polynomial potential.
Mm-hmm.
What you get from KKLMT is constant, a minus 1 over 5 to the 4th, and a plus phi squared. I mean, have you tried tuning just those? So the phi squared is going to affect the largest scales for this down on the potential.
That's in a canonically normal,
right. And near 0 with 1 over 5, it blows up, it smooths out. But okay. but in the region where slow roll is happening, those are the three terms that you've got.
Mm-hmm. So you're suggesting see what you can do if just you live with the big phi squared.
See what you can do.
Yeah.
The phi squared, the only thing you have, it'll affect just the biggest scale. So, you know, and you're running with a smaller scale than you said, right?
Didn't they have exponentials?
Not of the this is after freezing the body. This is the effective theory for the grain separation.
My perspective on this is that once you stabilize the Keller model, those that couple to the curvature, you really stabilize them at some high scale, then getting slow roll inflation becomes sort of a minor detail. Because there are so many fields in running around, and all that you need is semi-flat feature, let's say an extra room, with a double derivative, which is 1 over 60. And that doesn't seem to require so much fine tuning. So it seems that the key problem is stabilizing the Keller model.
Actually, I was wondering, so could we forget about the brain, anti-brain, and just use the volume modulus? But I mean, it's something you thought about too. Just have a potential which is kind of accidentally flat at its top. So you have a potential like this.
So,
and just, you know, that, but the same kind of 1% fine tuning that they do. A couple terms and we give something flat near the top.
For that you need to be at smallish volume. Smallish volume. Because you can sort of prove theorems that for a steep superpotential.
Oh. Yeah, oh, right.
You don't get the stable minima. And if you get stable minima, they're not really stable because they're very sensitive to initial conditions. If the field starts a little bit away from the features that you create cannot really hold. So my tentative conclusion is that you need to go to small volume, and then you can see, for example, if you take contributions from several brain.
Several brains.
BPS,
right,
so right. There's no problem in going towards the small volume. You get something that's, well, we don't know the prefactors, so it's hard to make conclusions, but they look like polynomials.
Look like
polynomials. If you take it with two exponentials, right. and
with terms that you can more or less do
independently. Right, and then that these type of features are not. Mm-hmm. In fact, Tom has a nice argument which, if it could be generalized, would be very interesting. Your argument in the Grabo-Witten case, where you say that the superpotential scales like MS cubed and the Kalers receive the volume corrections. That actually is perfect for the
these type of.
But you still need a 1 over 60.
Yes. But that removes all but that 1 over 60 from the. And 1 over 60 is their coupling parameters that float around that have these.
Yeah, well, what I would have imagined would have been possible in this game, but nobody seems to have done it. So if you have a situation in the following time, you have a compactification which is somewhat large in, you know, the higher dimensional Planck scale in such a way that you explain, say, the ratio between the gut scale and the Planck scale as written first in that volume. And you arrange all of the Susi breaking to come on grains, okay? So that the superpotential term does not get a volume enhancement. Okay. Then all of the moduli that control the bulk geometry have a natural scale. Their kinetic terms get the same volume factor that the graviton does. And so when you canonically normalize them, the natural scale of any potential you write in terms of canonically normalized fields is 1 over the 4-dimensional Planck scale. Some function of fields over the 4-dimensional Planck scale. And then if the Susi breaking came from a brain, that doesn't have the volume enhancement. So the overall factor of the potential is small. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in fact, something like the gut scale is more or less the right order of magnitude of what you need. And then if you look at a situation like that, then when you look at slow roll, well, generically a potential like that sort of gives you 1 e-fold of inflation. Okay. And now you have to start playing with dimensionless coefficients. So what I imagine when people started talking about these flux scenarios is that you could maybe manage to get some small dimensionless coefficients in the expansion of the potential around some point where the small parameter would be 1 over 1 of these large fluxes squared. And I'm a little bit surprised that it's proving so hard to do it. I mean, I don't know whether this is just because people have thought about a very particular scenario for inflation or not. But I would have, you know, because the rest of the scenario is sort of here. It is a kind of large volume compactification. I think it is reasonable here to think of the superpotentials as being generated on brains and so on. So,
so what is the upshot on the upshot of the potential? Like that, it's a single field for the potential with.
Well, it's single or multiple. Okay.
Okay, it's a potential. You end up with some function which has a small number out front that comes from this ratio.
I have it brush it up.
The upshot is you get a Lagrangian that in general looks as follows. You have a, you know, it's in general multiple field because it's string theory, as Jim said. Some metric on the field space. And then you have something that goes like M6 over M Planck squared. This four-dimensional effective field theory times V or phi over M Planck. Okay, well, that can depend on all of the phi's. That's sort of the generic thing that you get in this kind of a model where the one thing that's a little peculiar here or a little, you have to really imagine that the volume gets stabilized and the volume, the overall volume of the compactification manifold is not going to be one of the fields that's running during inflation. So that this big ratio between the Planck scale and of higher dimensions and the Planck scale of 4 dimensions sort of stays throughout the inflationary period. So you have to arrange for that to happen. And then once you've done that, the rest of the bulk moduli, like the complex structure moduli of the bulk manifold, okay, will naturally have Planck scale kinetic terms and Planck scale potential terms. Mm-hmm. And now if you write down Einstein's equations interacting with a Lagrangian of this type, in fact, everything scales out of all of the equations. Okay. you have there are no more dimensionful parameters in the and slow roll just becomes a question of, well, is the potential order one flat? If the potential is order one flat, you get one e-folding Lorentz collection.
But then you mean V of phi, right?
Yeah. Okay. So if I did a single field model, you sort of get a prediction of the number of e-foldings of inflation goes like an integral of V of x over V prime of x. Okay, that's completely dimensionless. Okay, nobody wonders, no one finds any place in the formula.
This doesn't depend on the symmetric on field space at all. You don't want, there's no sense in which I should canonically normalize this.
Well, those are small corrections,
I think. This is for canonical normalization.
Oh, if I've done
it. I went to one field and canonically normalized.
Okay.
And as I said before, again, if the phi dot is never zero any place throughout the motion, you can always effectively do that by going to the path length variable. But I think there is a point that you may be, you know, things that might look natural in the multiple field basis might look really funny when you write them in the So now, within this kind of framework, it seems like you need, you know, one number of order 100 in the dimensionless formula potential in order to get the kind of inflation that we need. And then in these flux compactifications, you've got numbers of order 100 floating around all over the place. And so, you know, I sort of expected to see a paper saying, hey, it works. Okay. And we didn't. We saw a paper saying, hey, it doesn't work. And so,
and that's what Andre said.
Sorry?
Andre said it worked.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's true that different. In private, different members of the collaboration at different points. But I think, you know, I'm finding it hard to understand why it's been difficult to do this at this level. I mean, if you wanted a model, you know, the type Andre likes with 10 to the 10th e-foldings of inflation, it's very hard to understand how that's going to come up.
This is because we insist on large volume, really large volume compactification. I think that's the reason. And there you get pushed to steep potentials for the volume. So that's what's killing you, not that. So I actually like this. This seems so nice, and I think in general you can probably make this argument also for supersymmetric free breaking that's not necessarily associated with rings.
But why did they have to have really large volume?
That's
and this is also assuming large volume, you know, which I believe.
Large-ish.
Yeah, large-ish.
But they want markers, yeah. And that's something that they impose on themselves.
Well, that gave them, they needed to get a controlled calculation.
Yeah. Okay.
For G2 calculations, for G2 manifold, for example,
I'm not
for example, for if you look instead of for Shell, the lipid G2 compactifications, the size of the.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or a few of those.
For this kind of story,
yeah, exactly.
For getting M got up Rem Planck of G2 compactification.
And then what happens is that you can't really know the form of the Kaler.
Yeah.
But probably just to argue that there is inflation.
So your claim is that the reason that it's not working is that in order to have control over the calculation of the Taylor potential, you want to be out at large volumes.
I actually prefer this version, which is closer to the central region. And then this argument actually shows that once you stabilize the Taylor model, you will also need the zero.
Yeah.
And getting this, you know, getting this type of potential, it's somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you have to look for the details. The other thing is that you sort of, the one, almost good predictivity, the one type of prediction that you get from here is that it's a small field type of model. You can't have the running over large.
What about the thing that Dave Spergel kept asking about was whether these multiple field models would generally have non-Gaussianity. I don't know if any of you guys have. Spergel seems to think that in general multiple field models would try to predict. I'm not sure I understand exactly.
Usually the story is that if you have the field contributing to the quadratic, the inflation usually contributes linearly. If it's a quantum field, its spectrum is just. But if you have fields contributing quadratically, yes, their spectrum will be chi-square.
Yeah, but why did they have to, why did the multiple, you know, if there's some trough in the potential, which is flat, and the transverse directions have masses that are order the Hubble parameter or bigger, then you just won't get fluctuations.
I think it's right. It depends exactly on what scale the two field model is. If it's dominated by one field, you're not at any one stage. If you see, people use two field models for very different things, right? They sometimes want to use them to completely get away from lots of the constraints of one field model. Sometimes they just want to turn off inflation, widen the space of 10 to the scalar ratios, things like that. If you just use it to turn off inflation, and I don't think you'll see anything like that, for exactly the reason you said, you'll have a steep potential in the other direction. There'll be minimal fluctuations in all your sinusoidal directions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you need multiple flat directions really in order to have these non-Gaussian.
The other thing is that chi-square, by the central limit theorem, goes to Gaussian, right? So you have to stay away from the point where the statistics is very good, because otherwise everything will be Gaussian. If you have chi-square, a chi-square distribution, and you want to tell it apart from a Gaussian, you cannot have too many points to sample, because if you sample too many points, the chi-square will be Gaussian. So these issues are quite tricky. You need a place where the chi-square is different than a Gaussian, but yet enough points to.
How long are we supposed to go?
What time is it?
It's about 11:40 or so.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I had.
Maybe
I can just flash this, and then people who are interested could talk to me afterwards, but. The last thing I want to mention, which perhaps relates to what Tom was saying, was what about the other extreme where instead of just having two or three inflatons, if we're in this landscape picture, well, maybe we're going to have dozens of inflatons during the course of inflation. And so how would you say anything about inflation in this picture? How would you test whether this is rise to the inflation that we see? And so I've thought a little bit how you might do that, but the first thing you have to do is guess what does this potential look like? Is it something like the racetrack mechanism for all these different fields, or what is it? Because I think you can't say much until you have some reasonable guess for what's the shape of this.
Are you thinking of this landscape as being the same one that you use for variabilizing the logical constant?
You mean?
I mean, there's usually a huge separation of scales,
right?
In the sense that
the barriers
have to be very, very high. So
yeah.
You know, our universe is stable for long enough.
Yeah.
So that you would expect that. There's a, you have to zoom in on one of the valleys, and then yes, maybe that's still very complicated. But then you're essentially, you have a field theory type of constraints that you were talking about in the first part of the talk. I mean, inflation is something that happens very late from the point of view of tunneling between valleys.
Yeah, so I guess this would be the last stage of that process.
Most features of landscape are blank.
So then so perhaps...
That makes this path that you've drawn, it's not clear to me that that's going to be a likely realization of this equation.
I see.
I mean, at least my understanding of how the landscape is supposed to work is that, you know, there's this famous right minimum of one that fits all the data and all of these wonderful things. And then you tunnel into the basin of attraction of that minimum. And inflation, if it occurs, has to happen someplace along that basin of attraction.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't be wandering over the whole landscape. Because staying in one of these different regions long enough to inflate creates a piece of the universe that's causally disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
We see whatever it means, it's certainly causally disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it can be having an effect on the last
okay.
roll down from you know.
I see.
What
so
I
this.
Always, is a tunneling.
So this picture really, if it.
They're typically not going to be in that basin of attraction a lot of other low minima.
The typical mogul has a height that's pointy.
But you're saying generally the scale of all the mogul. But there is a sense in which this helps just by the usual anthropic argument that it doesn't matter that inflation is not generic in these valleys. That, you know, it's just not going to be in one of the valleys where there's more inflation.
Yeah, no.
By the way, about these pictures, can you actually describe...
That officially ends.
he has the word anthropic on the top of the next slide. I just thought that would be where we'd end this.
Well, maybe it's not necessary for me to go to the next slide, because... if this picture is fundamentally flawed, then there's no
can
point.
Can you actually draw the cops of the models with any reliability? I mean, if the potentials there grow...
The justification for drawing the picture at all is effective field theory, so once they approach the font scale, they're up to the
Less than nothing to what the landscape, but the landscape was you guys have, which are apparently good company. there's minima that one tunnels from, like Raphael was saying. Okay.
Yeah.
But I think, unless I'm mistaken, Jim's here thinking of, you have a, I think you kind of are in the basin of attraction that what he was talking about, and then you've got moduli that vary. Now, you don't want to think about getting stuck in minima either. You want to think about just kind of moving around.
Yeah, I mean, if this picture did have any purpose, then it would be, as Raphael said, you're already in one of the major basins, but that thing itself has some structure.
I mean, you won't want to tunnel over the
planet. I wasn't assuming that you would tunnel.
But then it's back to part one of the talk, right? And it's no different from the problem that was being addressed earlier.
As a realization,
I didn't think that.
No. What did you say?
But wasn't it your point that this now sets up scenarios, multi-field scenarios, rather like the unusual in part one of the
Yeah, but that was based on my perhaps misunderstanding of this landscape picture that...
The landscape is just a generic function of many variables. That's not a generic function of many variables you draw, and Levy doesn't really draw it, but that's as good a way to as any, and
actually, if the volume is very large, then talks of the mountains go beneath the clouds, and then
there are some regions where they're beneath the clouds.
So, here's a generic function. Why doesn't your generic function not have a lot of variables in between Planck scale wall? I mean, if it goes from the Planck scale down to zero, there's lots of room.
The point is that around any given very small minimum, the typical vicinity of that will have features that are just on the generic scale.
Yeah.
Okay. The only way that you could avoid that is in this regime where the calculations can actually be done with reliability. The whole potential is pushed down.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, large volume.
And features here mean that there's some potential one wall around it, or just that there's some large Planck scale peak nearby.
Well,
that there is a co-dimensional one wall.
Lenny's way of drawing this picture
is
sort of deliberate gross negligence in the sense that you know, you're not forced to this very approximate field theory way of describing, you know, hills. I mean, it's a very sharp process where you nucleate the main wall, you nucleate a membrane, and it just very sharply separates different valleys from each other. So this, you know, this is a very nice picture, but in some sense it makes things approximate that you don't. It puzzles things out that are actually quite sharply defined in the theory.
Well, this is why I was trying to understand what's the relation between this membrane nucleation picture and an effective field theory picture where you're just describing everything in terms of scalars.
That I actually disagree with, okay, for the reasons that Lenny said. At least in certain models that we have good control over, like the Schwinger model in two dimensions, you can completely describe this membrane nucleation process, both in the regions where it's reasonable to think of it as membrane nucleation, and in regions where that approximation is no good, by a scalar field with a periodic potential. Or not exactly periodic, but a potential with a lot of sort of a tilted periodic potential.
In the regime in which the picture is very good, and that picture is a much easier way of seeing what the structure is than you just have to work through that.
That's fine, but I think
and it's a very sharp structure. It's not. These are not broad.
The hills are not broad.
Even if we live in a very sharply defined valley, I mean, even if it's a generic vacuum, it's a sharply defined valley with a co-dimensional one Planck scale wall around it, if all the inflation has to happen after you get into your basin of attraction, we have to live in a somewhat special valley.
Sure, yes.
So, I mean, it's not unreasonable that maybe the valley we happen to be in.
But of course, from the anthropic point of view, that's good. Right. The more special it is, you have to be, the more chance you have. I'm quite serious about this. The more special you have to be in order to survive, the more chance you have that you'll actually predict something. Okay. Because there will be very few places. I mean, that's the hope, I really think, although I'm quite a pessimist about this. I think the real hope in this is that what you actually need in this framework to produce a world that we could live in is so special that maybe it will predict some other things.
How is this reasoning called in socialism?
What?
Okay.
Right, it's the Marx. The worse things get,
the better they become. War is peace, freedom is slavery.
Okay. On that note, I think we should let people go.